As I call the meeting of the House Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee to order, welcome and good morning. Members, we're going to proceed right away with Chairman Davids, who is here with his bill, and then we can do introductions after that and proceed with other bills. So welcome, Chair Davids, and please introduce your bill to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 244 has to do with the Board of Appeals for an equalization course waiver. And I would appreciate it if Mr. Klayman could get into some of the technical details and then maybe go up to Mr. Sulem from the townships on why this is an important bill.
Before he does that, yes. Representative Davids, Representative Rarick moves House File 244 be entertained and then laid over for possible inclusion. Mm-hmm. Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, House File 244, provides a waiver for a requirement under current law regarding boards of appeal and equalization. Under current law, at least one member of a local board of appeals and equalization has to be present at each meeting of that board, and that one member has to have had at least one Board of Appeals and Equalization course, or have taken a Board of Appeals and Equalization course in the last 4 years. So what this bill does is it says that if a local board by February 1st of 2016 had certified that it was in compliance with that current requirement, but then for meetings of the board during 2016, there was not a member of the board at each meeting who had attended the required course in the last 4 years, then under this bill, what would happen is that if the governing body where that local board sits passes a resolution and makes a certification that it is now in compliance with that requirement, it would have its powers reinstated for the current assessment year. That's in the bill. To the extent that, well, I guess I'll leave it there, but and that would be in the bill for assessment year 2017, although there may be an amendment that moves that date up to 2018.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Klayman. Questions, members, or Representative Chair Davids, anything else you'd like to add?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And when we get to the point where Mr. Sulem from the townships could say a few words, that would be appreciated.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Sulem, welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. This provision is actually cut and removed from the tax bill of last year. And the reason the dates are set the way they are is we actually, Mr. Chair, respectfully are being requested the motion be that it move. This bill needs to be signed by the governor by the end of the month or it has no value to us. What happened was in 2016, the township certified by February 1st. They had gone to their training, received the certification required to do their local boards of appeals. What happened then was a small number of the townships, for reasons beyond their controls, the person who had been trained lost their election in March. We had a few that passed away, a couple that moved out of the township and ceased to be town officers. In any event, they were not able to have a certified person after they had already said that they were certified. These townships went to the online training from the Department of Revenue only to discover that the state had turned off said training, and we had not received notice of that effect. Our member townships did not receive that notice that the training would stop being available. And so we ended up with this catch-22 that they had to be trained. They thought they had somebody who was trained. That person, for a number of reasons, was no longer available by the time of the actual meeting date. What would happen in that scenario is they would then forfeit not only last year's but the next 2 years, 17 and 18, their ability to do local boards of appeals. Because there was this unintended consequence of and miscommunications about when training would cease and the availability to do the online training, the Department of Revenue has agreed with us that this language would take care of a one-time situation. And now going forward, We are now providing additional training. We've worked out the timing. We've given the notice so nobody is caught off guard. And that's why this has the dates it does for the 2016 and 2017 meetings and why we need it passed into the governor by the end of the month. With that, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem. Mr. Cummings, are you going to be a resource on this one? I understand he is. And then we'll do questions. Good morning, Mr. Cummings.
Good morning, Chair Drazkowski and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I was able to connect with Representative Davids before the hearing, and we do thank him for the work on this bill. The proposed bill would waive the requirement that at least one member on the local Board of Appeal and Equalization have attended an appeals and equalization course training within the last 4 years. The proposed bill would apply to township boards in 2016 for the requirements for February 1st of this year. I understand there is an amendment to move that to 2018. First, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to report on the progress made last year on our commitment to conduct 12 in-person trainings over 2015 and 2016. In addition, we have seen wide-scale acceptance of our web option and would like to share with the committee some of those results. In sum, for 2015, we offered 14 in-person courses. Eight of the 14 were offered at the eight regular session at the Minnesota Association of Township Conferences across the state. In all, we trained 379 individuals at eight regular sessions at MAT conferences. Thief River Falls, we had 28. Walker, we had 51. Carlton, we had 55. Fergus Falls, there was 55. Mankato, there was 39. Morton, there was 50. Rochester, there was 40. And St. Cloud, there was 61, Mr. Chair. We have also expanded this class to an online setting. I am also happy to report that even in our first year of offering online courses, our online participants outnumbered our in-person participants. In 2015, we trained 560 individuals online. The online course was available from July 1st through February 1st, 2016. The numbers are still not final for the time period ending February 1st of 2017. We've received positive feedback from individuals that took the online training with regard to the length of the training, content, and ease of use. As a way of contrast, in-person training historically took 3 or more hours plus travel time. The online course takes about 1 hour to complete without travel. While the online training is well received, we see areas of improvement, Mr. Chair, including our online registration. Legislation enacted in the 2013 and 2008 session requires that there be at least one member at each meeting of the Board of Appeal and Equalization who has completed an online or has completed an appeals and equalization course developed or approved by the Commissioner of Revenue within the last 4 years. The legislation was enacted in part as a response to complaints that were directed to the Governor, the Legislature, and the Department of Revenue. Under Minnesota Statutes 274.014, any city or town that conducts a local Board of Appeal and Equalization meeting must provide proof to the County Assessor by February 1st that it is in compliance with the training. Because the online training is designed to facilitate meeting that requirement by February 1st, the training is not offered between February 1st and July 1st. This time frame is necessary because the county assessor must set the type of meeting, open book or local board of equalization, time and date by February 15th, according to Minnesota Statutes 274.01. That date must be announced in the newspaper and on the valuation notice. In order to set the date and the type of meeting, the assessor needs to know which districts have a trained member and which do not in a timely way. Accordingly, the township clerk needs to notify the assessor by February 1st so that the date and type of meeting can be set. Offering training after February 1st would confuse the question of whether the statutory deadline for training has been met. Ensuring deadlines and training requirements are met is important, Mr. Chair. If, however, there are unforeseen circumstances after a member is already trained and the board has previously met the requirements, we can work with townships. For example, if a trained board member dies or steps down from the town board before the March township meetings or at the March township meetings, we certainly would hope that a board member would not die at the township meetings, Mr. Chair, but that may happen in the intervening time between February 1st and the March meetings. We allow new members to be certified in makeup sessions. In those cases, the dates and type of hearing has already been set. So after last session, we worked with the Minnesota Association of Townships, so we have updated email and other notification lists to ensure township officers have the ability to know about this makeup opportunity. With February 1st fast approaching, county officials will need some certainty on how to handle the local Board of Equalization, whether they should be boards or open book. It is important for all of our customers and property taxpayers that they have clarity about what to expect for their local boards of equalization. Having training completed on or before February 1st provides that clarity and transparency. So we understand that there's an amendment to move to 2018, Mr. Chair, but that still does not create an opening to be able to say that rules should not be followed for this season coming up. We can ensure that people understand the openness to make up sessions if the statutory guidelines are met by February 1st. Mr. Chair, we want to be partners with the townships in meeting these training requirements. We think that we have worked in good faith to meet the needs of our customers. We are always open to hearing feedback about how we can better serve our customers, and we look forward to continuing the conversation. Mr. John Klockseem, he's the Assistant Director of our Property Tax Division, is here, and he can be made available for specific questions about how this is done. And I will be here to stand for questions as well. If this bill moves forward, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, Chair David's staff, and the Minnesota Association of Townships.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Members, any questions for Mr. Cummings or others? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, are you suggesting that the Department of Revenue would prefer that we have our faith in you as an agency rather than a law change?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I don't understand I don't understand the dissonance or the point that you're trying to make. Can you explain what you're...
Well, Mr. Chair, based on what you just said in your testimony, I was led to believe that perhaps because you have these makeup sessions, et cetera, that changing this in statute is not necessary. Maybe I'm totally misunderstanding.
Mr. Cummings?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, what we have is we're trying to provide some certainty
yes.
to taxpayers, to county officials, to township officials, to local boards by February 1st. So we need to, so we want to make sure that when we provide that clarity and that clarity is made public, that we can ensure that that is what the taxpayers in Minnesota can expect. If they expect, based on what has been met, to be a local board of equalization, we want to ensure that that happens, right? That lives out. If they're going to expect an open book hearing, then we want to, you know, ensure that they can expect that. I think if you're asking to say that you wanted some certainty that the Department of Revenue will provide that training when a local board of equalization has been determined, I think that's something that we can continue to be open to. To continue to work on the language.
And Mr. Chair, he hit it right on the nose in this last statement. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Mr. Sulem quickly had a comment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I think there's a misunderstanding of what we're trying to accomplish here. All this bill does is address one very narrow situation that occurred in 2016. Mm-hmm. We're not asking for changing going forward. We're not asking for the training to be stopped. Our members are actually now finding value in the training. The work partnership with the Department of Revenue.
Imagine but, that.
Yeah, we were surprised, but pleasantly so. And what this does is we have this, what happens now with February 1st this year, February 1st, 2017, is they have to certify that they've been trained and that somebody at the 2016 meeting participation was trained. Because of the ceasing of training and the blackout window that occurred in 2016 that we were not aware was coming, our members were not aware was coming, we had a handful of townships that got caught in the, we want to be trained, but we can't, there's nobody available to provide training. That was a one-time situation, we hope, because we've offered more training. The department has really increased their notice out to members. And so all we're trying to do is say for those townships, the limited number of townships that were unable to have a trained member available in 2016, even though they were certified in February 1st, that they had somebody available, then by the end of March when the meetings occurred early April, that person was not available. But those townships do not forfeit their rights for 2017, 2018, and going forward. But they will have to be trained for this year. We're not doing away with training. It's simply saying the forfeiture that occurs because they didn't have one in 2016, that becomes an automatic forfeiture. We're suspending that forfeiture. That's why we're asking for immediate passage. That's why we're saying that dates do not need to be changed. It's dealing with a one-time scenario of a handful of gotchas that occurred in 2016. If we don't pass this by the end of the month, then those townships won't be able to certify February 1st of this year, which means they will forfeit their abilities for 2017, 2018, and 2019 before they can apply for reinstatement. We just think that's a pretty harsh penalty for townships to try to do the right thing. They have somebody trained. They try to get the new person trained, but because of a breakdown in communications, they were unable to for 1 year. That 1 year has already passed. So that's all this bill is doing, is taking care of the gotcha that occurred in 2016.
Thank you, Mr.
Schumann. And this language was agreed to by the department when it was in the tax bill last session.
Thank you. That discussion was helpful, at least for me. Mr. Cummings, does the government take money from the township officers for this training?
I'm not. Mr. Chair, no.
Thank you. Wow. Another first. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to apologize for being a few minutes late, so I just want to catch up here. I believe, Mr. Chair, Mr. Cummings mentioned that there's exceptions to the rules to have makeup situations when a town and a board of equalizer dies or is a vacancy. How come, I'm just curious, with the Association of Mitsunal County saying that there's just a handful, why change the statute versus having some makeup sessions just for this unique circumstance?
Mr. Sewell.
Madam Chair, Representative, we're not changing the law. We're simply suspending the requirement 1 year for those townships because what happened was that makeup training, nobody in 2016, we did not know it existed. There was no communication through our association. If it was on the department's website, we didn't find it. Our members didn't find it. We have rectified that problem for 2017 and going forward. So we just need this one-time exception for last year's situation where the member who was trained became unavailable through circumstances beyond anybody's control and trying to get trained but couldn't. So it's literally that small of a window.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is because there was nobody that was certified when the board meeting occurred in 2016. Okay, so this isn't something moving forward.
No.
So there's no other way to do an exception except for a rule change, so we can go back and train. All right, thank you. Just wanted to clarify.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt.
So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is kind of like a do-over. I mean, and there's precedence here because about every couple years, and Chair Davids knows this too, is we have small cities usually that won't get their financial forms into the state auditor.
Yeah.
And then what happens is they lose their LGA for half a year or a year, and we come back and have a law for just those cities for a one-time purpose, and it doesn't affect the formula or anything like that. So that's what I see this as, is kind of a one-time fix to get through this. So,
thank you, Representative Marquardt. Any other questions, members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a curious question. So those few townships that, because of a situation, didn't have a certified town board member on that equalization board last year, did they hold an equalization meeting, and was that meeting officially lawful?
Mr. Sewell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, There was a mix from the information we've received. Some did proceed with their meeting, and what happens is when they have to certify this year about what happened in March of 2016, they can't certify that they have somebody there. Others, the county stepped in and said, no, we are getting an open book because that person is not available and nobody is trained. So it was a mix of results because, again, the statutes aren't totally clear. When you had somebody trained, post-certification had occurred, and you had this unique situation. And so it was a little bit of a mix. And, again, all we're trying to say is let's not punish the ones who tried to do the right thing. They're doing the right thing now. They've had the training. Let's not punish them for the 3 years because of a situation beyond their control last year.
Thank you. Could we have the chairman come up about this bill? And thank you, Mr. Cummings. Mr. Chair, you and I talked about this earlier, actually, through staff members. You may want to hold off on the amendment. Is that your desire, Mr. Chair?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Rarick, the chair would like to maybe send this to taxes for them to entertain. And if they are unable to meet the end of the month deadline, it could come back to our committee. Would you be willing to amend your motion to send it to taxes instead of laying it over?
I will amend my motion.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. Representative Rarick moves to amend his motion, or amends his motion. I guess we don't need a motion for that, to move the bill instead to tax committees. Any more discussion on the bill, members? Hearing none, all in favor of Representative Rarick renews his motion to move that House File 244 be passed to tax committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion passes. The bill will move to taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Sulem. Okay, members, we're going to we're going to do our introductions that we held off on last time. Let's begin. Representative Erickson, would you like to begin introductions? But maybe if you could introduce yourself and then maybe where you're from and one or two quick items that you'd like to accomplish in committee this year.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Sandra Erickson. I represent District 15A, which is Mille Lacs, Sherburne, and Knevich counties. Two of those are, property poor counties. I live east of Princeton, and I live in Princeton Township. And to harken back historically, my father was a township clerk for all of his life. So El Dorado Township was very popular at our house all the time. So I have this instinct to, really govern from the best level of government, which is closest to the people. So accomplishing this year, of course, I have Mille Lacs County, so I'm always concerned about how we're taking care of the Lake Mille Lacs area, and I'll bring forth some issues there. And I also have trust land and lands in fee from an American Indian tribe in my district, so I'm always concerned there, too, about the loss we experience when land is moved to trust. So I'll be focusing more or less on a couple of local issues this biennium.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abigail Whalen represent Anoka and Ramsey, and one of the things I would really like to do is simplify the tax code, which I've been told in the past we've looked at it, 55 different classifications of properties in the state of Minnesota. I'd love to whittle that down just a little bit, Mr. Chair.
We are looking for a hero, Representative Whalen. Representative Loeffler.
Good morning. I'm Representative Diane Loeffler, and I represent Northeast and Northern Southeast Minneapolis. And I have the pleasure of this year serving as the DFL lead, and I'm looking forward to working with everyone on the committee to come up with a balanced package that meets the needs of taxpayers throughout the state. I hope that we have a comprehensive set of proposals that help us stabilize and reduce property tax burdens across Minnesota and help address some of the disparities in the system.
Thank you. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Regina Barr from Invergrove Heights, Sunfish Lake, and parts of Mendota Heights and Eagan. And I think, Michael, I would echo what Representative Whelan said. And also would like to see us take a look at the impact of property taxes, particularly on small businesses, whether that's a mom-and-pop shop here in the Twin Cities Metro or a mom-and-pop farm, you know, in greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Rarick.
I'm Representative Jason Rarick. I'm from Pine and Kennebec County. I would really like to see the simplification of the tax code as well, and help for our farmers when it comes to the school referendums.
Thank you, Representative. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Anderson, representing District 12B, just found out from Minnesota Milk that they had done a map, and my district has more dairy farms than any district in the state, so kind of proud of that. The ag property tax thing is a big issue. We're hearing land prices coming down a little bit, but again, there's that 2 or 3 year lag before we see that in the assessments and the taxes payable thing. Realizing full well that when you start making adjustments, you're shifting taxes as well. So I think the state credit on the school capital referendums is a good way to do it. And hopefully, too bad we missed a year last year with the tax bill not being signed by the governor, which means the farmer will have to pay the full tax again this year, but hopefully we can get that done. And the other quick thing I'd like to mention, a city in my district, Melrose, had a devastating fire on Main Street, much like Medelia last year, and there was a series of meetings. And actually, this came from somebody from Medelia that they had a business building on Main Street, and they wanted to rebuild that building, but in so doing, their property taxes would go from a couple $1,000s to $20,000 a year. So it's a real negative aspect of trying to rebuild after a fire. So instead of having the state make up the difference in property taxes, it was suggested to just freeze our tax rate at what it was in the old building. It wouldn't cost anybody anything if you would just let us pay our old property tax rate for a period of 5 or 10 years to help us get going again. So I'd like to work in that area, maybe focusing just on the city of Melrose, but maybe in general to make that happen in any case where there's some kind of a disaster and buildings are lost and folks want to rebuild, but because of the situation, it makes it pretty difficult.
Thank you. Mr. K.
Gary K., GOP Research.
And what would you like to work on this session, Mr. K.?
I still got the role of the chair.
Good answer. Ms. Schill.
Good morning, Kathy Schill, House Fiscal Analysis. And what I'd like to do is provide you good, timely information to make good decisions.
Excellent. And you do. Thank you, Ms. Schill. Representative Hertas. Vice Chairman Hertas. Yeah.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Jerry Hertas, and I represent 11 cities in western Hennepin County. And I was prepared to say last week when you wanted to do introductions but then canceled them that living in western Hennepin County was just 2.5 hours away, based on our weather. As far as some of the agenda, I'm always looking to work in the area of increasing fairness in our property tax system and certainly efficiencies within it. I share some of the other comments and concerns of my colleagues. You know, we have a complicated property tax system and like to work in that arena.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Ms. Robel.
I'm Allie Robel. I'm the committee legislative assistant, and I would like to properly record the minutes.
Dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Thank you, Ms. Robel. And so, members, if you have any questions about scheduling or anything else for the committee, this is the gal you talk to. Steve Draskowski, House District 21B, and I'm in Winona, Wabasha, Goodhue, and a portion of Dodge County. I would like to work in earnest again this year. Last session, I authored the bill that ended up in the House omnibus tax bill and in the conference committee report as well that provides that farm school construction property relief for farmers. And before I began working on that last session, the last 2 years, also looked at the house, garage, and an acre approach, and I'd like to go venture into that again, realizing we have, I think, kind of established that the legislature has resolved that we're going to do something in this area, and certainly at a minimum, looking at the proposal we had before us last time, I think it might be an opportunity for us to actually fundamentally and properly change the way we collect that tax if we combine them both together. And I've invited Representative Marquardt and also the department to join me in that, and Mr. Hines and others are going to be helping us dig into that and do some work. So looking forward to doing a good job with the farmers so that we can provide that relief so that we can bring fairness back between the people in town and the people on the farm. Mr. Rubis.
I'm Stephen Rubis. I'm the committee administrator, and my goal is to slightly less annoy nonpartisan staff this session, which is not going to be an easy goal.
Goals, Mr. Rubis, need to be attainable. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Steve Hines with the House Research Department, and I cover most aspects of property taxes and county program aid and property tax refund. I would echo Ms. Schill's comments to provide timely and helpful information to the members.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Mr. Klayman.
Thanks. Chris Klayman, House Research, and I handle all the other issues of property taxes that Mr. Hines doesn't handle. That would be more of the legal issues related to things like property tax administration, assessments, delinquency, tax forfeiture, and I would echo again the comments of Mr. Hines and Ms. Schill on we're here to work with any member on any property tax related issue that they would like us to work on.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you. I'm Michael Nelson. I represent House District 40A, which is the southern half of Brooklyn Park, past home of Representative Hurtas. And anyway, I learn more about my goal is to learn more about property taxes. I served on this committee once for 2 years, and I just get a better understanding of it. And I echo what Representative Loeffler said, is that we need to make sure that it's fair for everybody. As when one person gets their property tax lowered, someone has to go up to maintain a balance of income coming in for the state.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Hello, Representative Joaquin. I represent Hopkins and half of St. Louis Park, and I share what Representative Erickson was saying. I served for 9 years on the City Council, and I do believe we need to restore some balance with the difference in laws between state and local, and too many times we take too much power away from our local government. So I'd like to maintain that balance. And then I also am working on a way to help small business owners, so maybe Representative Barr would be interested in my bill that gives a freeze on increased value on property taxes that when a business rehabs an older property. So we'll have to be talking later. But I've spent 2 years on this committee and still have stuff to learn and really enjoy it. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe we should do the overview like three times throughout the year, Representative Joaquin. I agree with you. Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Keith Franke, District 54A, parts of South St. Paul, Cottage Grove, all of Newport, St. Paul Park, and Great Cloud Island Township. Just excited to be here on this committee. I'm looking forward to bringing a little bit of a local official's viewpoint, similar to Representative Joaquin here. Coming from being a mayor, sometimes see how things affect and roll down to the cities. So just hoping to bring that to this committee, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. Welcome. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Andrew Carlson, representing 50B, which is in Bloomington, Minnesota. Goals. I've got lots of goals this session. Specific to property tax, serving on the Bloomington City Council, I can definitely understand what a lot of the comments made here today, but I think in general I'd like to see some sincere property tax cuts to middle-class Minnesotans and small businesses.
Thank you and welcome. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Paul Marquardt, represent District 4B, which comprises all or parts of Clay, Becker, and Norman County. And when I'm not down here, I teach at Dilworth, Glendon, Felton. I've taught for 34 years, and I'm honored today to have one of my former students who will be testifying on Representative Lean's bill. So that's an honor today. As far as top priorities, certainly the ag credit on the school building bonds, and besides that, going further and seeing if we can kind of repair an outdated system when it comes to taxing agricultural properties, and just looking at property tax relief overall, also just out in rural Minnesota and so forth, which tends to create a lot of obstacles. So always a pleasure to serve on this committee with you, and look forward to working on that effort also, Chair Brzezinski.
It'll be a fun adventure, Representative Mark Bright. Thank you. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Ben Lean. I'm a third-term member from District 4A, which is Moorhead and Oakport Township. And I also look forward to doing what we can to reduce property taxes for people across Minnesota, homeowners, renters, folks on fixed incomes, but certainly I think starting with a couple ideas that were in the tax bill last year, largely with the ag property taxes, with the small business property taxes, is a good way to start. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lean. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Lunan, I represent District 55A, which is Shakopee in River South, and the two townships south of the city of Shakopee. And some of the things I hope to accomplish, I'm new to the committee here, is that when we have discussions, we use the word tax, but really the appropriate word is cost, because the fees, the ancillary fees that are around some of these things that people have to pay, is in fact the same mechanics as a tax. It's a cost. We're taking money from somebody else and we're deciding where it should be spent. I also am concerned about situations where we go out and we create or levy a tax, and then after we have the money, then we walk around and look for something to solve with that money. And it's like buying a hammer. Now we're going to walk around the house and look for a nail to hit. I think it should be the other way around. I think problems should present themselves, and levying tax or collecting somebody else's money should simply be a solution to an existing problem. I also am aware of the inequity in the ag tax. I think there should be fairness. Several members have mentioned fairness. I think what a person should be paying in taxes should have a relation in property taxes should have a relationship to the services that they're utilizing. What of those costs are they causing? And that's out of whack right now, and needs to have a hard look at it also. And then just simplifying it. Right now, in almost every tax situation, we have these problems. We have a really smoky room, so we know there's a fire, but it's so smoky, it's so confusing, we don't know where the problem or where the fire is. So let's clarify, get rid of some of the smoke, and then we can pinpoint a solution to what specifically is a troublemaker, an outlier, and resolve that.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Ms. Richardson.
Yep, I'm Molly Richardson with DFL Research. I hope to provide useful analysis to members, and I would echo Mr. Rubis' comment, try to minimize my annoyance to House Research.
Thank you. And then our House page. Could you come up to the microphone? You have to try that chair out. You really have to try that out. Could you introduce yourself and welcome?
Yes. My name is Annika Jansen. I'm the page on this committee, and I look forward to serving.
Thank you. Ms. Jansen or Jensen?
Jansen.
Jansen. Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for your work already. Ms. Dalton.
And I help serve you in the areas of local government aid, levy limits, and local sales taxes.
Thank you. Ms. Manzi.
Nina Manzi in House Research. I work with a function credit state refund, which is the property tax refund for homeowners, the property tax refund for renters, and the special property tax refund. I share, you know, all the staff's goal, which is to help you all have information to use to make decisions.
Thank you. Mr. Michael.
Joel Michael from House Research. I work for this committee largely on tax increment financing. And my goal is to help you all understand the Byzantine tax increment rules. to deal with whatever legislation you're going to deal with. And I'm never annoyed by either Mr. Rubis or Mr.
I like that adjective, Mr. Michael. Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, I'm Sean Williams from House Research. I'm going to be assisting Mr. Hines on property tax issues and, in particular, property tax modeling. And I guess my goal, I'm new to this issue area, so I'm looking forward to learning and getting more informed.
Thank you. Is there anyone we forgot? I think we've got everyone. Thank you, members, and thank you, staff, and everyone who introduced themselves here this morning. So again, members, especially those of you that are new, these resource people we have, our House nonpartisan staff, are amazing people, and the work they do and how resourceful and capable they are. They will actually chase you down if there's part of your bill that needs to be addressed that they've got a question with. So they're also persistent in catching up with you. And so go up to the sixth floor and roam around up there and find these folks, and they'll be glad to help. So, okay, our next item of business is House File 163. Is that Representative Lean's
bill? Mr. Chair.
Oh, it's my bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hurtas.
Just organizational business. I'll move the minutes from the last meeting.
Oh, thank you, Vice Chair Hurtas. So Vice Chair Hurtas moves the minutes from the January 11th, 2017 meeting of this committee. Any additions or corrections to the minutes as presented? Okay, hearing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes from the January 11, 2017 meeting, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The minutes are adopted. And, Jerry, you want to take the chair?
We'll welcome Chair Drazkowski to the Property Tax Committee. We'll move House File 163.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the contents of House File 163 were brought to me by an individual who works with the Wabasha County government. I believe it was the assessor's office. And brought to me the fact that they were having issues that they were hearing from farmers who were getting caught by having their 2B land having penalties against their 2B land submission of their taxes because they were late. So they're getting late penalties. And so these are farmers who would own land that had the deadline of November 15th and then also land that had the October 15th deadline. So what this bill does, and maybe I'll have Mr. Hines describe it a little more technically, is moves all of those deadlines to November 15th so that we don't have farmers getting caught by not understanding the deadline on maybe one parcel or five parcels that are not properly connected contiguously. So with that, Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Hines can bail me out a little more here.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Mr. Hines.
Oh, Mr. Clement, I'm sorry.
Mr. Clements?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski. So what this bill does is it moves the due date for second half property taxes for rural vacant land, that's Class 2B land, to the same due date that it currently exists for 2A land, which is the agricultural property. A little historical context here. Between 5 and 10 years ago, agricultural land was split between 2A and 2B, and the 2A classification retained the November due date, where the 2B ended up having the same due date as most other property classifications in October 15th. So this would move the 2B due date up to the same due date as 2A. Just one other comment on that, I suppose, is that in case anyone was wondering, that the rationale for the later due date for agricultural land is to give the farmers a chance for the harvest to come in before they made their second half property tax payment. So That's sort of a background of why that date is the way it is. The other thing the bill does, it also conforms the penalty schedule for Class 2B rural vacant land to what it is for what the 2A land is. So there's some conforming changes there. And then also in the bill, line 1.22 through line 2.22, that just deletes, or that just strikes an obsolete reference, but that doesn't change the substance of any provision in the bill. So.
Thank you, Mr. Clem. Is there any questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and as many people have said today, this is a complicated area of law, and I don't remember all the 52 classifications. I'm just wondering if we could get a refresher on what rural vacant land is versus other agricultural land.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, the split that Mr. Clayman referred to a number of years ago has to do with the 2A is basically what now we call productive agricultural land. So it's crop land or pasture land, anything where productive agriculture is taking place. And 2B is rural vacant land, which is sort of all the other land that is out there that typically just wooded, rough lands, et cetera. But sometimes there are some situations where 2B land around the 2A productive land can be kind of included in the 2A for various reasons, if it's impractical to separate. They're taxed the same, so the same tax rates apply to 2A and 2B, but this kind of quirk occurred when we split agriculture under the 2 and the 2B. It wasn't clear whether that was, strictly speaking, agricultural land anymore, and the department has interpreted it as to be not agricultural. And so sometimes, a lot of times, farmers have some of both in their holdings. And there's already a provision that says if their tax statement includes multiple parcels, some of which are 2A and 2B, it all is on November 15th. But if you have a separate statement for just a 2B parcel of land, that's due on October 15th. So this is basically trying to streamline it. So all that rural land, productive or non-productive, is on the November due date.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Representative Loeffler.
And thank you. That's helpful. I'm kind of imagining the sloughs and the swamps and scruff woods. Is that kind of a fair assessment? Would it also include land set aside in some, like, CRE CREP program or something like that, too? Or
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, that's basically correct. And the CREP lands, I think it might matter what they were in before they went into CRP. But another big area of 2B is hunting lands or a lot of rural land in the northern part of the state. And that maybe gets into a little bit of why, you know, it isn't so uniformly accepted that it really should be with that later date, because when you get into that rural land that's really more like hunting land and not so much connected with farming, the rationale for the later payment isn't there. But there is a trade-off between that and simplification, I think, that's being addressed here.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
And thank you for your expedient work in the Property Tax Committee. You mentioned 52 classifications. We've already collapsed three. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, it's interesting that if vacant land and productive land have the same rate, that there would even have to be this separation. But that aside, what is the rate for these kinds of parcels?
Thank you, Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the rate for homestead land is 0.5% on the first $2 million, or just right around $2 million, and then 1% on the homestead land over that threshold. And then for all non-homestead land, of productive or non-productive, it's
1%.
Representative Erickson.
No, Mr. Chair, that clarifies things.
All right, thank you. Are there any persons from the audience that would like to testify about this bill? If not, would Revenue like to comment on this bill? Seeing none. Chair Descalzi, do you have anything else to add?
No, just thank you, members. I think this is a good government bill that lines up deadlines and helps people avoid confusion in the system and makes it just a smidgen simpler. So thank you for your discussion today. And
Chair Daskowski renews his bill for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Okay, Representative Lean is bringing House File 174. Representative Carlson moves House File 174 to be entertained and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Lean, and your testifiers here today. Please introduce your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill, House File 174, pertains to agricultural property agricultural homestead properties and the homestead property tax refund. And the origin of the bill comes from meetings I've had along with Representative Marquardt and Senator Eakin with farmers in Clay County over the last couple of years, where we're in a very difficult situation right now where, specifically with the Minnesota ag economy, where crop prices are relatively low compared to the high land values, and so from that the high property taxes for ag land. This is causing a real problem for producers and farmers as they still have that property tax bill to pay every year, but they're not receiving the income that they had in previous years, recent years, from their crops, from their production, even though yields have been good. We've been having good growing seasons. We still have the low crop prices. And so what my bill would do is take the homestead property tax refund program and open it up so that farmers are eligible for refunds based on their entire homestead land value. Currently, the law states that egg producers are only eligible, the land value is only eligible on the house, garage, and 1 acre, and so this would open it up to the entire homestead property. In effect, producers who right now receive that refund, they would receive a larger refund. It would also open up the refund to, I believe, about 31,000 new farmers across the state. And, Mr. Chair, at this time, I would like to turn it over. I have a couple testifiers with me, some farmers in Clay County, Mr. David Craigness and Mr. Trent Item.
Thank you, Representative Lean. Welcome, Mr. Craigness.
Yes.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is David Craigness. I'm a farmer from Clay County, Minnesota. And I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to be here on your first session of your tax committee this year so we can you can include some of our thoughts as you go forward in your discussions about tax fairness. So I have passed out some of my, the bulk of my remarks are in hard copy and have been passed out to you. I'd like to just share just a short background for a part of this tax discussion. Contrary to visual appearances, I'm a small family farmer. My local bank, Bell State Bank, says that a minimum size they suggest for a viable single farmer entity is 1,500 acres, and I farm 1,350 acres, so I use myself as an example. I'm certainly not talking about a big farm. If someone lives just down the road from me in an identical house as I live in, but works in town, they can have the exact same income as me and therefore paying the same state and federal income tax. They can have the exact same net worth as I do, regardless of what that net worth is. And they can have theirs invested in stocks, a vested pension, 401k, antique cars, gold bullion, or whatever. But since mine is invested in 940 acres of farm dirt, at the end of the year, I owe $38,000 more to the county and school than they do. It makes no difference if the land is paid for or mortgaged above saleable value of the taxes due. I'd please like to understand how this can be considered fair. Again, the tax makes no differentiation how much equity is in the property, nor the ability of the owner to pay the tax. My farm of 1,350 acres in its entirety would have to come up with about $58,000 to pay the tax, regardless of profitability. My tax bill in 2010 was $23,621. By 2016, had grown to almost $40,000 for the farm. for the farm had jumped from $33,000 to $58,000. During this time, the land prices went up in my neighborhood, and that was the reason, one of the major reasons for the increase in the property tax. However, I did not buy any land during this time frame. I did not bid up the land. And therefore, I don't consider that this should be penalizing me. I did not create the problem. It would be like if someone, one of your neighbors, bought a new Escalade and the insurance cost on your minivan went up. Someone else did something that results in me having to pay more taxes, and I can't understand how that's fair. Business property taxes are a factor in your discussions, and so for the sake of discussion, let's talk about a single-owner business in Moorhead or Dilworth. There's a Dairy Queen in Moorhead. It's on the best corner in town. Its property taxes, according to the Clay County website, are $3,783. There's a liquor store in the town of Dilworth that's on the main street, $3,046. There's an auto shop in Moorhead called Duggan's Auto. $3,728 is their property tax to the county and school. None of them are taxed as much as 90 acres of farm dirt, and yet each of them provide a place for several people to work. Duggan's Auto is an especially good example because it is operator-owned. It has the father, a son, and two workers that are provided employment there. And yet, their property tax is about 10% of mine. In the Dilworth-Glendon-Felton School District, there are 155 farmers. That's about where half of my property is located. 3.6% of the voting residents in the school district are farmers. If the building bond bill that last year failed, if that had passed, farm dirt in the district would have been assessed just over 66% of the cost. 3.6% of the people paying 66% of the cost, regardless of ability to pay. Again, please tell me how this is fair. Non-school. About two-thirds of my property tax bill is for the Clay County. 60% of the county expenditures are for social services. Much of it is unfunded mandates from the state. Bare farm dirt yields no children for schools, but it also produces no need for social services. Farmers, I think, understand the need for county and township roads, and that's a disproportionately their burden. But the other county expenses levied against bare dirt are also unfair. A bit of history. When 95% of Minnesotans were involved with farming, and every family had 80 acres and two cows, I can understand how the idea of an ag property tax was supposed to fare. Any tax that even comes across 95% of the population today would be considered extremely fair. But things have changed. Excuse me. Minnesota farmers are facing tough financial times right now. Let's not lose sight of their long-term financial importance to the state. Ag brings in new money from out of state. It's not just a recirculation of cash among the residents. This is an important distinction in the long-term tax reform is how you're being considered. This is an example. If a doctor from Mayo Clinic buys a boat that's made in New York Mills, a lung boat, and he buys some beer from New Ulm, Minnesota, and goes to Warroad, Minnesota, and has a vacation, that's economic activity that's circulated in the state. This is all good economic activity. However, it didn't bring any new money into the state. And the aluminum that was used to make the beer cans and the boat both had to come from outside the state. So somewhere the state has to have some new money come in from someplace. If I and my fellow farmers grow a unit train of soybeans that gets sold in China, that's new money coming into the state, which I think is more important economic activity than it ever gets credit for. The legislature has made some good first steps when they admitted that school excess levy referendums were an unfair burden on farmland. I applaud them for that step. Now is the time to take more steps down the path of a fair tax policy. Now, I doubt that this body is going to rise up today and say we should take all taxes off of farmland. All in favor say aye. I doubt that's going to happen, even with this heartfelt and inspirational testimony. But I would hope that you understand that this is a necessary process and that the 40% reduction in the school taxes that's being suggested is not enough, and it's not an answer to this slavery that we've been put into. In my mind, the school property tax should be on 1 acre house in a garage, as was mentioned as an idea here earlier. Ag property, if it's going to be taxed, should be priced at the time of sale only. County social services should not be paid by ag property tax. I thank you for this opportunity, and I would like my neighbor, Trent Item, to get some comments.
Thank you, Mr. Craigness. And Mr. Item, welcome, and please proceed, sir.
Thank you, Chair, and to the committee for the opportunity to speak. I am here.
Your name again, Trent?
Trent Item.
That's I-T-E-M?
E-I-D-E-M.
Item. Thank you.
First of all, I let anybody guess which one was Representative Marquardt's student, David.
I would say the young guy on the left.
Remembers.
Mr. Chair, I think it's the young guy on the left.
Thank you for your humor today, Mr. Adams.
My position here is to try to share with you the perception of a small young farmer who's trying to basically make my way in the farm community. I will start by saying that this property tax is definitely an ag issue. The farmer always pays the property tax. Even on rented land, I've never met a landlord who meets increased property tax without raising rental rates. So that makes it difficult for young farmers to get land and to keep land. Also, it's very difficult to cash flow farmland on a limited balance sheet, and which is what most beginning or young farmers have. So once you add in the extra burden of the property tax, it becomes very difficult for a young farmer to purchase land, farmland, and therefore making it almost impossible for him to get a foothold or even increase his position or grow his business. Considering that historically about 30% of farm operations survive to the second generation, only 12% to the third generation, and 3% to the fourth generation, how will the proud tradition of farm families providing food for the state continue if the young farmers are continue to be hamstrung by the high property tax? They need these footings. They need the time when they're young to get a footing for success, and if they can't get that, they'll never have a chance to succeed at the same level as previous generations. Also, I want to point out that I feel that the way farmland is valued is flawed. You simply can't determine the value of farmland the same way you determine the value of a home. The home market is a fluid market. If I want to and I have the means, I can buy a new house in the general neighborhood I want to be in anytime I want. Basically, every day there's a house for sale. If that quarter land near the farm comes up, that might come up once in a lifetime if I'm lucky. More likely, it's going to come once every two-plus lifetimes. The average national turnover for farmland is about 2% a year nationally. That's a very limited opportunity to get that piece of ground that you've been coveting for years. Also, farmland values are also artificially inflated by that 1031 exchange. You can currently exchange development land for ag land, and that skews the system, and it's totally independent of the farmers. The farmers have no play in that at all. Farmer is ancillary to that process. Also, it was a few years ago we did have 18 months of unprecedented $7 corn. I cannot fault any farmer who took that added buying power and invested it. That's the way you succeed. That's the way you advance your business and grow your business for yourself and for your family. However, it seems unfair and that 18 months is going to affect the value of property tax for the next 20 years. It's a flawed system. It shouldn't dictate that much. Finally, and David mentioned this, farmland does not belong in school referendums. The highest property tax burden I have is on a piece of ground that is in a school district which I do not live. So, therefore, I'm required to pay for a school referendum which I had no vote in. Now, I know that that's been common practice for years, but I still think it's taxation without representation, which flies in the face of the cornerstone of our democracy. I think either ag land should be excluded from school referendums, or owners of ag land should have a vote in the school referendum, something like a vote for every 20 acres or something, which would give a value probably similar to the average home in a lot of communities. Also, the percentage of school referendums paid by farmers, as David pointed out, is grossly out of whack. I've never in my life seen a school bus pull up to a cornfield or a beet field or a soybean field or a wheat field and load a child up and take them to school. And I wager to guess if I live 100 years more, I won't see it. But even in our most rural school settings, there's 1 to 2 farm kids per class. Yet they're paying the 66%, two-thirds of the cost of the school. It's just too far out of whack that that such a minority pays that majority of the cost. So I was happy to hear during the introductions that a lot of the members of this committee are for family farms that are for the fairness in property tax and reform and school referendums and all that. So I was happy to hear that. But and I appreciate your time. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Item. Members, any questions for the author or Mr. Item or Mr. Craigness? Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Item. Just curious, in Brooklyn Park, there's a historical farm called the Item Farms that's spelled the same way, and I also purchased part of that Item Farm many years ago. Do you have any family from Brooklyn Park or Item Farmers in Brooklyn Park?
Mr. Item.
Not to my knowledge, sir. There are actually, even in the city of Moorhead, there are two totally independent Item families, but there is a town in Norway named Item, and the presumption is that people who came from that town just kept the name. So.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertaus.
Well, my question to Mr. Craigness, I just kind of did the math. So your input cost per acre on the taxes you're currently paying is about $43 an acre. And that may or may not have a degree of predictability. I know most farmers, you know, try and keep their input costs for corn around $400 or $450 an acre if they can. Obviously, that affects your profitability. You know, location plays a big part in it as well. My own experience in Hennepin County, I'm doing some farming, and I'm paying about $120 per acre, which makes it unprofitable, but I still do it. I'm just curious, what is your thoughts or either of your thoughts about Iowa taxes of farmland based on production? Or what do you think about a conversion of paying taxes on your land based on production?
Mr. Craigness?
Thank you, Chairman. I believe that's fundamentally a pretty good idea, and the state of Minnesota currently has that in place. It's called income tax. If farmers make money, they pay income tax, and so I'm not sure that an entire new system to try and assume profitability, and then you further have the complication: are you growing Brussels sprouts, or are you growing sugar beets, or are you growing corn, and is the farmer in fact choosing the highest and best use for that land, or could he choose a crop that would be more profitable were he to choose to certify organic or whatever else? Exactly the devil in the details of deciding the profitability of a piece of ground is extremely difficult in my mind to get something that is assumed to be fair and is in fact workable. So I would prefer to have a property tax or to have an income tax across all residents of Minnesota, and then if the residents choose to do something in the state, then they will all be participating in that choice.
Mr. Item, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I agree with David. If you wanted to gauge the value, the profitability of the land, you'd have to look at the profit. And there's the only linear, logical way to do it. I guess I'd prefer to see a division, if we're going to rebuild the system, to look at where the value that needs to, that the land requires, comes more from the land. For like Representative Lunan said, you know, if it, you know, for county roads, for example, to a farm field, that makes sense. That's very linear to me. That makes sense. But other than that, you know, to pay for nursing home care or something like that, it seems like that doesn't, that's not linear. So I guess I would like a more linear correlation, I guess is what I'm trying to say. and linear, because I just want to say that one more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess we had testimony when last year, I believe it was, Chair Daskowski and members of this committee went on the road traveling, asking questions about property tax, and certainly that came up in southern Minnesota where some farmers were actually farming on both sides of the state line. In the Iron Range, for example, we've got areas of land that are in mining production, and they don't pay real estate property taxes, but they pay a production tax based on what they produce. So I just was wondering what your thoughts were on that, but thank you for your comments.
Thank you. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe this question is directed. Is it Mr. Kragness?
Yes.
Okay. So you had referenced a nice example in your testimony regarding taxes compared to other businesses in your community. Can you tell me what the taxes would have been for you if it had been more in alignment with those taxes?
Mr. Kragness?
In alignment is a curious measure. If I were to pay the same amount of tax as someone else who employs four people, and my oldest son and my son-in-law take time off from their independent business to help me plant and help me harvest, so we could make the case between my wife, I, and the two children, we employ four people part-time for the year, then a fair comparison of property tax would be I'm employing four people, Dugan's Auto is employing four people, we should have roughly the same property tax.
So you're saying...
Representative Barr?
$3,700.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Mr. Kragness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would say that $3,700, if they're paying $3,700 and I were to pay $3,700 and we had the same number of people making a living off this enterprise, if you were, then that would I could call that fair.
Representative Barr?
Thank you. That's all.
Thank you. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe this question would be for Representative Lean. A lot of discussion about the equalization of property tax here between, you know, business and farming. Granted that farming is, you know, a hard and proud profession. But am I correct in asking or saying that this bill addresses a credit refund? Is that correct?
Representative.
Not an equalization of any type of property taxes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Frankie, yes, that is correct.
All right. So then my next
Representative
Mr. Chair, my next question would be to the testifiers that in reference to these other small businesses don't get any type of a refund, but understandably you live on your property. But does this bill then asking for the entire scope of your property then to become refundable? Is that correct?
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frankie, that would be correct under this. Granted, it is a homestead, you know, not the non-homestead property, but the homestead ag property, yes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative Frankie, I kind of caught the same thing when Representative Lean was introducing his bill. I didn't know that this credit was only on house, garage, and an acre. And so, members, as we think about this, you know, we're taxing them on all of their land, and we're providing the credit only on the house, garage, and acres. So there's some incongruity there. We need to maybe look at changing one or the other in the long term to line things up properly. And so anyway, good discussion. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that agriculture faces some unique issues, particularly in this point in time, and it's pretty volatile, and that we need to seriously consider a whole variety of responses. You mentioned some that were considered last year in terms of the school property tax relief and some of those other sort of things. And I think we need to look at that, and we all need to learn how that works. But I have grave concerns about changing the longstanding homestead credit refund program, which has really been about rewarding and assisting people to own a home, into a business subsidy program, you know. And I think that we should probably look at other approaches to dealing with the challenges of the agricultural industry. When I first saw this bill, I thought, well, you know, I've got a bunch of businesses that have the apartment or the home behind it or above it, and, you know, should I propose that, you know, they also be able to kind of combine their business? And I think in the discussion of goals, simplicity came up. And I think we really, I personally think we'd be better served to keep the Homestead Credit Refund Program uniform across the state for all homeowners. That's really about your homestead, about your yard, your garage, where your kids play, and deal with the business taxes and some other ways. We've got all kinds of tools in our toolbox, and we've been pretty creative about using those. I think that this would really be hard to explain to homeowners in other parts of the state that that it's treated differently depending upon what type of other things that the homeowner's involved in. Whether it's they own the Dairy Queen that's connected, you know, that's in the front of their home, or it's, you know, or some other commercial business, or they're happen to be a farmer. And so I think this is really changing the purpose of it, and it makes our homestead credit budgeting, I think, subject to the volatility that we've learned a lot about in agriculture. And so I think we'd have to really kind of think about that as well. So I think we've learned a lot about some of the issues that are confronting it, but I think maybe looking at assessment practices and some of the school burdens and some of those other things might be a way to address those issues while at the same time not making our homestead credit program into something it really I don't think was designed to do.
Thank you. And members, we do have another bill to go through and a short overview as well with the majority leader and her bill coming up. So I'm going to take one more question, Representative Marquardt, and then I'm hoping we can proceed. Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And you can tell by the insightful testimony, we've had some really good discussion in Clay County. And we've had several meetings with farmers and trying to look at things. And, you know, we really, and I know this bill is more than just the school building bond debt, which we're looking at too, but we really have put farmers in a very unfair, untenable position when it comes to school building bonds. And just for an example that Mr. Craigness and Mr. Item has mentioned here, the DGF school district, and there was one in Barnesville, and actually Detroit Lakes in the district, but had those passed, those school building bonds, it would have been probably $10 to $14 an acre increase. So, I mean, you're looking at just a quarter section of land, 160 acres, that's $1,600 to $2,200 a year in taxes for the next 20 or 30 years. I mean, it's cost prohibitive with kind of the perfect storm that farmers have hit with low commodity prices and rising market values and aging school buildings. And so I think there's I think Representative Druskowski, you're getting to this. We have to look at as many different kind of avenues and approaches as we possibly can, you know, whether or not its production value might be a better deal than market value. I mean, I don't know, because a lot of other states use that type of an approach, but, I know that, and I'm glad that you two are here to testify to kind of start things off, because you do really bring a different perspective on things. You're not just talking about kind of the way we talk about things, but how it relates and how you compare to other businesses and so forth. So I really appreciate that. And so thank you for traveling down. And Mr. Item, you know, you made that initial comment about if you were still a student and I was giving you the grades, would you have made that statement at that point? It was that, Mr. Item, I was still giving the grades, Mr. Item.
Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Marquardt knows that I would. Also, I just want to state, I know David passed out some information on his. If anybody would like some of mine, I can get Representative Marquardt or Lean the digital copy I have with me, and he can disseminate it to the committee if someone would like to see it. So.
If you get that to us, we will disseminate. Thank you, Mr. Item. And Mr. Craigness, very compelling testimony, and as Representative Marquardt pointed out, really kind of a good kickoff to this issue, which is at the heart of rural Minnesota right now. And so thank you. We're going to have more discussion, and maybe we'll see you at a future hearing here again, yet even this session. So thanks so much. Mr. Cummings has some quick, resourceful insights that he'd like to bring to us. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative Lean, and members. I will be brief. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The administration shares Representative Lean's goal, and I know a goal that you had espoused too, Mr. Chair, for providing tax relief to Minnesota farmers. As you know, property tax on farms have increased by 114% in the last decade. To relieve that property tax burdens on Minnesota farmers, Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith, and I know that you had it in House File 848, Mr. Chair, have proposed a credit worth $34 million for owners of agricultural property for taxes attributable to school district debt levies. However, as we're talking about agricultural property taxes and how they are calculated and linked, I wanted to ensure that something is put on the radar screen, and we don't have to necessarily deal with it today, but hopefully it can be dealt with throughout session. I know that you're working, Mr. Chair, to provide some creative solutions on property taxes. This proposal will provide additional property tax refund to some property tax owners who have linked homesteads across ownership types. Under current law, linked ownership types are likely not eligible to receive a property tax refund. For example, an individually owned agricultural homestead that is linked to a trust-owned agricultural homestead would not qualify for a PTR. This change may pose difficulties to property tax owners who co-own parcels regarding determining which co-owner should apply for and receive the property tax refund. For the agricultural homestead credit, agricultural homestead chains with both homestead and non-homestead value, the agricultural homestead market value credit is to be calculated on the total market value of all homestead and non-homestead agricultural land in a homestead chain and then prorated to each owner's occupant's percentage of ownership. The agricultural homestead credit is administered on a number of ways across the state, Mr. Chair, resulting in unequal treatment of taxpayers depending on where they live in the state. So this bill proposes an inconsistent approach to the application of homestead for property tax relief programs. It actually might exacerbate some of the inconsistencies that already exist. That's not to say that we don't support additional relief. The governor has proposals to provide additional relief, but it is something, especially with the conversation that I think you're trying to have, Mr. Chair, to try and standardize some of these, that would be very helpful. As part of the governor's budget, in addition to the relief, I already mentioned Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend making changes to the calculation of the credit for fractional agricultural homesteads based on the market value of homestead land. Their proposal clarifies the application of agricultural homestead for fractional agricultural homesteads. The proposal also clarifies that the percentage of homestead would be split evenly among the number of owners of the property. While this bill and the governor's proposal focus on different relief mechanisms, without addressing some of the underlying inconsistencies in application, this proposal could magnify the differences in application of agricultural property tax laws across the state. So we are here to answer additional questions. I do understand, Mr. Chair, that this is a long-term discussion throughout this session, and we look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, Representative Lean, and others.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings, and thank you, Representative Lean, for bringing this bill and for putting forward a creative effort here. And members, it's we all need to go into the workshop and come out with our approach to something constructed to bring forward here. So thank you for doing that, and I really appreciate that. Any other quick questions for the author of the bill? Okay. Last discussion for you, Representative Lean.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we have to get moving here. So I really do appreciate the conversation, Representative Hoffler, and to the department, I'm certainly sensitive of those concerns. But the bottom line is this is, 2 or 3 years now coming that we've been working on this issue, and we need to get some relief out to farmers. I mean, that's just the bottom line. They're just having a tough time paying that property tax bill, and we all know we have to pay that bill regardless of if we're making income. So, again, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the conversation and look forward to it over the next 5 months.
Thank you, Representative Lean. And members, with that, House File 174 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, Mr. Hines is going to give a brief overview of fiscal disparities.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. In the interest of time, I'm going to start the presentation while Ms. Dalton is helping set up the computer with the presentation. You should have the slides presentation in your folders, and I think I'll just start from there until we get up on the screen. What is fiscal disparities? Fiscal disparities is a program for sharing commercial industrial tax base among all the taxing jurisdictions within the seven counties of the Twin Cities area. That was enacted in 1971, and it's been in effect ever since 1975. The goals of fiscal disparities are generally, there's two kind of overarching goals, to promote orderly regional development and to improve equity in the distribution of fiscal resources. Lots of times that first goal is kind of overlooked, and the emphasis is on the improving the equity side of it, the redistribution, but there really is another element of it, which is orderly regional development. How does the program work to achieve the goals? There are a number of elements of the program that sort of feed into these two goals, according to the proponents of the program, I should say. It spreads the fiscal benefit of business development attracted by regional facilities, the idea being that if some regional decision causes there to be development in a certain part of the metropolitan area, all the parts of the metropolitan area can share in that development, or in that added development by sharing that tax base. Another one is that it makes communities more willing to accept low tax yield regional facilities such as parks. So the idea there is that you'll be able to communities that allow more park space won't necessarily feel penalized that they're giving up space that could be commercial industrial, because the commercial industrial property base comes through the program. Equalize the imbalance between local government's public service needs and financial resources. That relates to the equity side of the equity goal. Reduces incentives for businesses to relocate to areas with lowest tax rates. Because there is a common tax rate across the metropolitan area on commercial industrial property, there's less of a advantage for a business to shop for a lower tax rate place. And then finally, the flip side of that, it reduces the incentives for communities to try to offer tax concessions to attract business development, because it's going to be shared by to some extent by all the communities. So those are kind of generally the elements that the proponents of the program first put forth and still advocate today as reasons why this program exists. I should have maybe started saying this is a very unique program internationally. We constantly get inquiries from other states and regions about doing a program such as this, and there's been very little there's been very little success in actually implementing this in any other place. So far as we know, our program is pretty unique, especially of its magnitude. So it was kind of an interesting public policy development in the 70s that's existed, still in existence today. How the program works, the contributions, so for a start, each community contributes 40% of the growth in its commercial industrial tax base since 1971 to this abstract concept called the area-wide tax base. And this value that's put into this area-wide tax base is not available then for the local jurisdiction where the property is located for taxation. So 40% of it is put into a pooled tax base that's to be shared and not available to be taxed locally. This area-wide tax base is then distributed out to all the jurisdictions in the seven-county area
through a formula that's based on the population of the municipality and its relative tax-based wealth. So the more wealthy a community is relative per capita, on a per capita basis, the less the distribution it receives, and vice versa. Each municipality is allowed to tax this distribution tax capacity that it's getting from the pool at the same rate as the tax rate that is paid by its own residents. So it doesn't get to tax it more or less than the same tax effort that's being paid by the local residents of the jurisdiction. And then finally, often when we talk about this program, we talk about municipalities, but in fact, this all types of taxing jurisdictions, counties, school districts, special taxing districts, also share in the distribution. But we tend to focus on the cities because they're the most easy to talk about in terms of where a jurisdiction is. But it shouldn't be confusing that it's more of a city program. It really does affect each type of taxing jurisdiction in the same way. And as far as how it affects individual commercial industrial properties, a portion of the tax on each commercial industrial property is paid to their local taxing jurisdictions, and a portion is paid to the area-wide pool. So for a homeowner or an apartment property, their tax burden is entirely based on the tax rate of the jurisdiction where the property is located, and it should say tax rates, the county, city, school, etc. For a commercial industrial property, typically they'll take like 65% of their tax will be based on the tax rates in the jurisdiction where the property is located, and 35% of their tax will be based on this area-wide tax rate. 35 is a rough number that varies a little bit from place to place. The next couple slides are an attempt to sort of get this concept across graphically. This is very old graphic, so bear with me. But this slide one here is a pictorial illustration of three cities, City A maybe in the upper left being one with lots of commercial industrial properties, City B more mixed with residential and commercial industrial, and then City C is the mostly residential property with just a few commercial or industrial activities in it. So this is where the properties are actually physically located. Then slide two, we see that now we've created a fourth box called the area-wide pool. And if you can sort of see what we're trying to show in the pictures there, you'll see that in City A, City B, and City C, a portion of each of the commercial and industrial parcels is missing. So we've taken a chunk of each commercial industrial property and put it into this thing, this abstraction called the area-wide tax-based pool. Then slide three now shows what happens after fiscal disparities distribution, and we show in the lower corner or the upper corner the amount of tax base that's being given back to the cities from the area-wide tax base, and you can see that on nets, if you studied the little pictures in more detail, you'd see that on net, City A has really given up some of its tax base. It didn't get as much back as it put in. City B is probably getting back about as much as it put in. City C is getting quite a bit more back than it put in. So it's equalizing that resource across those three different types of jurisdictions. Again, it's a rough diagram, but it might help some people to understand what's going on. The next slide is just trying to get at, show you how sort of big this program is. So this is looking at how much fiscal disparities tax base is of the total tax base. And so the solid line is showing that what is fiscal disparities tax base is compared to the total metro tax, CI tax base. And you can see that the approximately 35% of the total commercial industrial tax base is actually being shared through the fiscal disparities pool, and that sort of makes sense. It's 40% of the growth since 1971, and so that makes it about 35% overall. That it varies a bit from year to year, but it's right around 35 now, and it should stay up in that 35 to 40 range going forward. The dotted line is showing the how much that this area-wide base is relative to the total tax base in the metro area, and that's at about 10%. So approximately 10% of the tax base in the metro is shared through the fiscal disparities program. The next slide is showing the growth in the levy over time. The solid line is the amount of dollars distributed. The dotted is just inflation adjusted. And you'll see that it's now at about $600 million of distribution levy. And it grows. I won't try to get into why the growth pattern is as it is. There was a big change in 2001 reform where lots of things in the property tax system changed, but it's been growing fairly steadily ever since. And most years it does grow. As far as the distribution of or what the net redistribution that occurs for taxes payable in 2017, these graphs tend to look at are showing it at a countywide total level, and the first pie is the contribution side of it, and the other is the distribution side. But you can see on the contribution side, the thing that probably first notice is that Hennepin County actually contributes 52% of the area-wide tax base comes from Hennepin County. The other counties, you can see their percentages are shown. And then the distribution levy, you'll see, distribution side, you'll see that Hennepin County gets back about 36% of the total. You can see that, you know, generally the shape, the pieces of pie maybe are somewhat similar, but Anoka is one that has a fairly big difference between its. It puts in about 7% and gets back about 14%. Ramsey is another one where there's a big net difference. They put in about 15% and get back about 22%. So those are maybe the two biggest deviations, plus Hennepin, as far as how much they get back compared to how much they put in. And then finally, the impact on taxpayers, just maybe very briefly. So we've talked about tax base. What really a difference does it make in terms of taxpayers and tax burdens? We did a property tax simulation of what the world would look like if there was no fiscal disparities program. And the last time we did this in 2012, we're intending to do it again soon here, but as far as I can tell, things haven't really changed much since 2012. The patterns are pretty similar through time. On homestead properties, on average, you'll see that in Anoka County, we think homestead properties pay about 8% less in Anoka County on average, 3.8% less in Ramsey County. And you'll notice that on homesteads, all of them are negative except Hennepin County. But even in Hennepin, where homesteads are negatively affected on average, it's only about a 0.5% increase on homesteads. For commercial industrial properties, we find that almost all counties, there's an average increase on commercial industrial properties, but of a degree between, looks like the highest is 8% in Dakota County and 7% in Washington County. Ramsey County is the only one where commercial industrial properties on net see a decrease of 1.6. Again, countywide averages can be misleading because it does vary much from city to city. I think in the interest of time, I won't go through the slides that look at city-by-city impacts, but you can look at them in the chart. And we do have a report on our website that's about a 50-page report with more detail on this program. And in your packets, I also have a two-page version of how the program works. And I'd be happy to answer questions, but I think I'll leave the rest of the time for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. And members, we're going to hold off on questions. We're going to bring up the majority leader's bill and act on that and bring that into committee. And, you know, we'll have more discussion on this, and Mr. Hines will be here for us to maybe review this packet again and have further discussion. Thank you, Mr. Hines. Majority Leader Pepin, welcome.
Hello.
I will, before you get started, I will move that we entertain House File 166 and that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you also move the amendment to get it in the proper shape?
Thank you. And the chair moves the H0166A1 amendment. Representative Pepin, can you review the amendment or just tell us what it does real quickly? Or can someone?
Yeah.
Mr. Clayman or Mr. Hines?
Let me just grab it. It's a very short amendment. It just clarifies that it's the bill's about communities that are not served by regional wastewater services under Chapter 473 and that instead own and operate a municipal wastewater treatment plant. So that's very clear. It's a more narrowed in amendment to more closely get at what we're trying to get at here.
I remember it now. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Any discussion on the amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amendment's adopted. Majority Leader Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now that the bill is in the proper shape, House File 166 provides that any municipality that owns and operates its own municipal wastewater treatment plant cannot be required to contribute more than 10% of its net tax capacity to the area-wide tax base. Of the 180 cities and townships in the program, the city of Rogers has been the largest net tax contributor or net loser in terms of percentage of total tax base lost to the program. Rogers is an outlier, and we're not saying that Rogers shouldn't contribute anything, but we're saying that they shouldn't be required to pay more than 10% net tax capacity because it's significantly more expensive to own and operate a standalone city-operated facility as opposed to receiving the benefit of the economies of scale that go along with the Met Council system. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the City Administrator in Rogers, Steve Stammer.
Mr. Stammer?
Yes.
Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Steve Stammer. I'm the City Administrator for the City of Rogers. As Representative Pepin mentioned, this bill would cap the fiscal disparities contribution for any city that owns and operates its own wastewater treatment plant facility to 10% of the city's net tax capacity. First, let me reiterate that the City of Rogers recognizes the basic goals of the fiscal disparities program in terms of maintaining a strong and vibrant region. Our concerns are not with those core goals, but rather with the practical application and unintended consequences of the program in some extreme situations. We believe that Rogers provides a concrete example of excessive impacts that can occur under this current legislation. And to illustrate that, I would note the following historical impacts within the City of Rogers per Exhibit A in the blue bound handouts. Exhibit A on page 7 illustrates that over the past 10 years, the City of Rogers has contributed nearly $25 million in tax capacity to the pool on a net basis. This amounts to an annual loss of revenue to the city of about $1.1 million in real tax dollars at our current tax rate. The city's average tax levy, as you can see on Exhibit A, the city's average tax levy over that same 10-year period was about $4.8 million, meaning that the city contributed on a net basis an amount of money in real revenue dollars equal to about 23% of its annual levies. And I think we can all imagine the crisis that we would be facing if the state of Minnesota were to lose an entire year of revenue every 4 to 5 years. That's the amount of the order of magnitude of the loss that the city is facing. Rogers has been a net contributor since at least 1980 when the city was only 600 people. The City of Rogers is not a bedroom community that relies only upon the urban core for jobs and commerce. Rogers is a town of just over 12,000 people, but has created more than 10,000 jobs, so we have more jobs than we have working-age adults. We're committed to continuing to grow jobs and pursuing economic development, but the disincentives provided by the fiscal disparities program make that very difficult to achieve. Mr. Hines noted that concerns with businesses shopping for lower tax rates. We see that in Rogers. Being on the border of the metro area, we have seen multiple large industrial users leave Rogers, leave Hennepin County, leave the seven-county metro area to move just across the river into Wright County. We've seen Blue Dot, Room and Board, the Walgreens Distribution Center all leave within the last 2 years. For 2011, the study that Mr. Hines noted, the 2011 data is the most recent data available for the thorough study that was done by the Department of Revenue. The city of Rogers in that year lost 20% of its tax base to the pool on a net basis. So after the distribution, we still lost 20%. The second most impacted city that year lost 15% of its tax base, meaning that out of the 180 jurisdictions, Rogers lost the greatest percentage of tax base. And number two on that list, Rogers was impacted 25% greater than number two, who happened to be Bloomington. Obviously, Bloomington contributes a greater number of dollars, but as a percentage of tax base, in 2016, Rogers will actually lose about 70% more of its tax base than Bloomington in comparison. The result of that in 2011 was that the city's tax rate and the local tax bills on the city portion of property taxes was 34% higher than it would be without the fiscal disparities program. More updated numbers, not complete, but in 2016, the impacts included a reduction of $2.9 million, or 14%, almost 14% of our taxable tax capacity. That caused an increase of 15.7% in the city's property tax rate, and so the city tax bills that went to our property taxpayers and homeowners in Rogers were 15.7% higher for the city portion of taxes. That amounted to a real loss, again, of $1.1 million in revenue in 2016. And to put that into perspective with the city's budget in terms of what we lost in revenue to the program, the $1.1 million would be higher than our fire department and our building inspection department budgets combined, nearly as much as our entire public works budget was lost to the fiscal disparities program. Two quick items of note specific to our legislation and the reason why it is tied to operation and ownership of wastewater systems. Exhibit B on page 8 is the blue and red shaded table. This is per the Department of Revenue and the Metropolitan Council, the top 20 net contributors, so net losers to the fiscal disparity system. You can see that Rogers ranking number 2, Oak Park Heights number 1, primarily due to a single public utility property of $200 million there in Oak Park Heights. This illustrates that Rogers is the only city among the top 20 contributors that does not own and operate its own wastewater treatment plant. Exhibit C on page 9, the next table, is specific to cities that own and operate their own wastewater treatment plants in the 7-county metro area. There are only 15 of those cities. Every other city that owns and operates its own wastewater treatment plant is a net recipient of the fiscal disparities program, with a minor exception of Greenfield, which loses about 1.5% of its tax capacity compared to the 13.7% that Rogers is losing. What this table shows, the four cities that would actually, in our estimation, the four cities that would actually benefit from the cap, the 10% cap, Rogers' contribution would be reduced by $1.9 million. The next highest on that list is $57,000. Almost all of these other cities are significant gainers from the program, again, with the minor exception of Greenfield. And with regard to our wastewater treatment plant, the city currently owns and operates its own wastewater treatment plant, valued at approximately $10 million in terms of today's value on that. We are facing a looming expansion of about $25 to $30 million to handle expansion needs. We do believe that the Met Council is ultimately going to be taking that treatment plant over, but that's at least 10, possibly 15 to 20 years away. We know it's more than 10 years away, potentially 15. I would note also on this same table, we are showing the impact to the pool, to the fiscal disparities pool. We're mindful of the fact that we're not looking to significantly impact the pool. At the bottom right-hand corner of this table, you'll see that the entire pool for 2016 was $370,000, and if this had been enacted for 2016, it would reduce the pool of available tax capacity dollars by only 0.5%, about 0.5%. A key justification for the fiscal disparities program has been that new growth is made possible due to the shared infrastructure that is shared regionally. Within the 7-county metro area, the only core infrastructure that is regionally funded is wastewater. Roads have no regional funding mechanism. They're funded at the local, city, county, federal, state level, but not regionally funded. Wastewater is. And while Rogers is not served by that regional system, we still contributed nearly 19% of our tax capacity to the program on a gross contribution. A couple of quick points to wrap up. You will hear from the Metro Cities Group, of which Rogers is a member and very supportive. The bill such as ours should be considered only in the context of a larger review of the entire system of taxes and credits. And we believe that more study should be undertaken with regard to fiscal disparities and other taxes and credits in the future, but we also firmly believe that this type of excessive impact experienced by Rogers needs to be addressed from a fairness perspective, regardless of changes that may be necessary in the future. In terms of those other taxes and credits, Rogers does also not receive local government aid. And in summary, I would just note that this legislation would reduce some of those excessive impacts for cities like Rogers by placing that cap on the contributions. We have attempted to narrowly write the bill so as to not negatively impact the pool, but yet it is not special legislation specific to Rogers because we understand that other cities, maybe Greenfield in the future, other cities of that nature, may need this same type of relief as they move through their respective development life cycles. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Stammer. Is Ms. Nauman here? Would you like to speak on this bill? Welcome, Ms. Nauman.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. Metro Cities represents cities in the 7-county metropolitan area at the legislature and the Metropolitan Council. I'll be very brief here this morning, and Mr. Stammer has pretty much said what he knows what I'm going to say. But I just want to say that Metro Cities does support the fiscal disparities program. We do oppose having any diversions from the pool to fund specific objectives. I know that's not what this is doing here today. With respect to having legislative changes that would modify or impact the fiscal disparities program, the organization's policy position does state that we would prefer to have that legislation, any such legislation, be considered within a context of larger property tax or efforts to reform the state's property tax aids and credit system. And if you do undertake such efforts, we would ask that you do include local officials in that work. But so I don't have a specific policy position on this particular bill, just that any bills that would change the program be considered within that larger context because there are impacts on property taxes and other aids within the property tax system. So with that, I would stand for questions. I will just add also that the City of Rogers has provided some very important perspective into Metro City's policy positions and work, and I am sympathetic to their concerns and certainly want to continue to work with them on their concerns with the program. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Any quick questions, members? We can maybe discuss this more later. Representative Carls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And perhaps this is for the, is it the Mayor of Rogers?
City Administrator.
City Administrator. You mentioned the eventual takeover of your wastewater treatment plant from the Met Council. You mentioned 10 to 15 years. At some point, could this committee get some testimony on that? If there is a way in which that could be expedited, I mean, if that's a means towards providing some of that relief, so you wouldn't have that asset in which to maintain. And by the way, what is the age of your current wastewater treatment facility,
Mr. Stammer?
Chair, Representative, I don't know the age. I know it's we're talking at least 30 years old at this point, and there's been expansions over that period of time. My understanding, and we've been working with the Metropolitan Council very closely with their staff and with our representative Rodriguez, Councilmember Rodriguez, very closely over the last several years, and even going back probably 15 to 20 years in terms of the discussions. At this point, the time frame with regard to the takeover of the Rogers system and Metropolitan Council then operating the sewer treatment services for the City of Rogers is primarily tied to a new treatment facility that would be built in the Northwest Metro.
I see.
And that is on their capital radar, but it is not within the next 10 years. So is in the planning processes. Our understanding is that process itself from conception to construction is at least that 10-year period. So that's the window we're in right now.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you. Representative Whalen, quickly.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Madam Majority Leader. We chatted about this last year, and thank you for bringing the bill again. And I would love to talk to you more about potentially how we can move forward, because I do agree with Ms. Hellman and Metro Cities about looking at this in the context of comprehensive reform. One of my predecessors was one of the key, actually I think the chief author of the fiscal disparities program, and so it's definitely a big topic in my district, but I would like to work toward addressing the problems that you've discussed, because I agree there's definitely some equity issues that we should be fixing. So it's not necessarily a question but comment that I'd love to have more conversations.
Thank you. Thank you. Majority Leader, any final comments?
No, I just appreciate you having me here again. This isn't the first time we've been here, and my city has been kind enough to come. I mean, Rogers really is an outlier, and if you really think about it, 12,000 people, over $1 million in fiscal disparities, and it really is an equity issue. And if you look back at when the program started, almost 50 years ago, things have really changed, and this really does need to be taken a look at. And if we're not able to do an overhaul of everything, I think we do really need to take a look at communities like Rogers, who really is just an outlier and really negatively impacted by it. Our community is, really facing a lot of issues because of it, and I understand that anytime we make change, it causes a little bit of pain for other communities as well, but it really is time to reform the system, and short of a complete reform, we really appreciate you taking a look at providing a small amount of relief to these four communities.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing the bill. With that, the chair lays over House File 166 for possible inclusion. Members, the meeting is adjourned.